Scotch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about the new film, Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse, The Boogeyman, Shooting Stars, Platonic, and the season finale of Ted Lasso. I'm also going to be talking about the news, the trailer park, and the home cinema roundup featuring 65. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@themovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
Let's talk about the box office really quickly. The Little Mermaid easily won the weekend, but it was at $96 million for the three-day and $119 million for the Memorial Day four-day weekend. Coming in a distant second was Fast X. Now, as good as The Little Mermaid was, I mean, it wasn't as big as Beauty and the Beast or Aladdin. It wasn't pushing $200 million, but making over $100 million during Memorial Day weekend is not bad for a movie. Fast X, though, came in quite a distant second. In the three-day, it was $23 million, and in the four-day, it was $28.5 million. That's a pretty significant drop. I mean, we're talking well over 65% from week to week, which is kind of a catastrophic drop for a Fast and Furious movie. Now, that's making plenty of money overseas, but that's showing that it's running out of gas here in the States. And it's funny, even then, I just saw a news article that Vin Diesel is blaming the over-the-top performance by Jason Momoa for stealing the scenes and then getting the bad reviews. But generally, if you read the reviews, Jason Momoa's performances was getting the best part of the reviews. Most people thought that was at least fun, but the series is running low on fumes, we'll say. Now, last week, FUBAR, which I talked about on the show, which I thought was fine. If you recall, I was like, yeah, it's a fine little passable action series. I didn't love it. I didn't hate it. It's sort of a return to comedic action form of Schwarzenegger. That got some pretty harsh reviews. But in very true Netflix fashion, it then became the number one series on Netflix, knocking off Queen Charlotte, which is a Bridgerton spinoff. And I think this is interesting. You kind of have to look at this outside of the writer's strike, because Netflix has been the bad guy in the writer's strike, partly because it's a studio, but also partly because it's a streaming service and streaming residuals are what the big issue with the writer's strike is. But setting aside the stuff that's going on in the writer's strike, because that's ultimately temporary. This will eventually get solved and Netflix will be paying people properly for their residuals. And then we'll kind of just go back to the argument over streaming versus theatrical releases. But the stuff that becomes popular on Netflix oftentimes is not well reviewed. I mean, almost to the point that it almost exclusively is poorly reviewed, but it does extremely well on Netflix. The entire career of Adam Sandler on Netflix shows that people will still watch what's put on that service, whether or not the critics like it. FUBAR has gotten some pretty mixed reviews, but it is way up there in terms of watching. And within its first 4 days, it became the highest watching thing, and it changes every week. It's whatever's being watched at that moment. And Queen Charlotte had been number one for a couple weeks, and it dropped down, but it only took 4 days for FUBAR to hit the top spot. And if you don't believe that the poorly reviewed stuff is still doing well and being watched aggressively on Netflix, you got to go down. In the story I was reading, it was all about Schwarzenegger and it was all about FUBAR. But what I found most interesting is if you went down to the films portion of the numbers and you found out that The Mother, Jennifer Lopez's movie, that has been number one for 3 weeks. The most watched, and I'm not talking about just slightly most watched, the most watched by a mile. It's still the most watched movie on Netflix. And that thing got raked over the coals by the critics. I thought it was okay. I didn't love it. I thought it was passable. But that's something to really note. Netflix, in terms of the number of hours being watched and the number of minutes being watched, the quality of the movies based on what critics say, the qualities of the shows and the movies, does not necessarily sync up. So you have to realize that just because something gets poorly reviewed does not mean it's unwatched. And that's sort of a lesson as we go forward. The critical community, film Twitter, gets a little high and mighty and thinks, we rejected this, why are people still watching it? And this is, I mean, the whole entire Transformers series is an example of people watching stuff and making a point to watch stuff regardless of what the critics say. Listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer part. The first one I want to talk about is the new trailer. This is a couple weeks old, but it's the new Barbie trailer. And I think it's worth mentioning because it's still a month and a half before it comes out. They got a new one out there, which gives you more story to it. And that's coming to theaters on July 21st.
Cold shower. Ooh. Falling off my roof. Ah! And my heels are on the ground.
What do I have to do?
You have to go to the real world.
Barbie in the real world. That's impossible.
If this got out, this could mean extremely weird things for our world.
This would be catastrophic!
We haven't played with Barbie since we were like 5 years old.
Oh.
No one rests until this doll is back in a box.
The first trailer, when it came out, I didn't get any information from that trailer. It was just looking at what the Barbie world looked like, the original teaser trailer, and it gave you that visual element, but had no idea what the story was. And apparently now the story we're finding out is that Barbie and Ken go to the real world and have to deal with being in the real world, which is kind of a tired concept. I know it's been done over and over and over again, and things get done over and over and over again because they work. But I as cool and as pop and bubblegum as the Barbie world looks and how it might be fun for like 30 minutes, I don't know how good the movie's going to be. And I like Greta Gerwig's stuff. And I think if anyone is going to pull this off, she could. But I don't know. This feels almost too much of a stretch. This feels almost too absurd even for a Barbie movie. And I don't know if it's going to click. I mean, it really is trying hard and it looks like it might be fun, but I'm like almost like not buying the self-awareness that they're in the real world. I don't know. We'll see what happens when the movie comes to theaters and I get a chance to check it out. The next one I want to talk about is The Creator, which is coming to theaters on September 29th.
10 years ago today, the artificial intelligence created to protect us detonated a nuclear warhead in Los Angeles. For as long as AI is a threat, we will never stop hunting them. This is a fight for our very existence.
We're the same. We can't go to heaven. Because you're not good, and I'm not a person.
Did you locate the weapon?
Yeah, it's a kid.
This is directed by Gareth Edwards, and he's best known. I mean, he did movies like Godzilla, which I had some real issues with how he dealt with Godzilla, which I think was improved when it was moved to other directors as we moved into King of All Monsters and Godzilla vs. Kong. But his biggest feather in his cap was doing Rogue One. And I loved Rogue One. I thought Rogue One was fantastic. I don't want every Star Wars movie to try and be Rogue One, because what I find fascinating about Rogue One is people are like, oh, you're just into nostalgia and you just want to relive everything. But my favorite Star Wars movie is the one that's basically living on nostalgia. It tells a great little story, but there, on set, if you read anything about it, it was wrought with problems and a lot of it on the shoulders of Gareth Edwards. But this new Creator movie looks like it might be really interesting. It's got some high concept sci-fi going on, and it deals with artificial intelligence and robots and artificial life forms. And I think it has some interesting stuff that we can contemplate. But of course, there have been plenty of movies that deal with these topics and tropes. We'll just see if this is able to break out and do something interesting, or whether it slides down and kind of becomes a bore. We'll see when it comes to theaters in September. Coming up next on Fat Guys at the Movies, I'm going to be talking about Shooting Stars and Platonic.
Y'all ready for this?
And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump into the movie reviews and start talking about Shooting Stars. This is available on Peacock, and it's based on LeBron James' book. The sports drama tells the story of his time playing high school ball. Muscle
paid the price. When we were young, I was just trying to find good kids. They all kind of balanced each other out. Willie, both his parents, addicts. His big brother took him in, saved his little brother's life. Shion, we just want Shion to work off a little bit of his baby fat. Drew was born with basketball in his blood. I picked LeBron because he has skills and he was a good kid. His mom just wants a spot where he can be safe and not get me in trouble.
Come on, pose, Denzel.
We value all the talent you boys are going to bring to this school.
I'm from Ohio. I'm from Columbus, Ohio. I got family from Cleveland, so I'm well aware of LeBron James and his roots. And I like LeBron James. He's spinning his fame as well as you could when you're given that much fame and money. So yeah, I mean, I like LeBron James as a star and as a role model. I think he's good, but I don't care about basketball. And there's a line in the movie where somebody's like, oh, everybody in Ohio knows that this is happening. And I'm like, I didn't know. But it tells the story of him with his friends as they are going through high school. And I found the most interesting part of it was less about LeBron, because you know what's going to happen to LeBron. And he's been in the spotlight since he was a teenager. I thought it was more interesting watching his friends and his classmates come to terms with the fact that they're not LeBron, that he is a superstar and he just got better and better and better. And some of them were actually considered more talented than him when he was younger, but they just peaked and he never peaked until he got into the NBA, where he was just this phenom basketball player. The movie's well made. I'm not going to say it's a poorly made movie. My biggest beef with it is I wasn't terribly interested in it. It gets deep into minutiae, I guess is the right word for it, of like high school basketball and of choosing a school in the Akron area based on whether or not you're going to become a basketball star, and sort of that internal politics of high school basketball, of which I am completely disinterested in. But I guess if you are interested in it, that would be worthwhile. It's sort of like, it reminds me a little bit of that movie King Richard with Will Smith about the Williams sisters, which was more about him than it was about the girls. But in that movie, in King Richard, it kind of goes into that minutia of tennis, of how tennis works. Not just the games, but sort of the politics of it and who gets to play and how you get to play. And that stuff is, I mean, just colossally uninteresting to me. And I feel the same way about this. And so it has trouble focusing on LeBron versus his classmates. And I think his classmates have a more interesting story because they're the ones who did not become like the greatest basketball player of their generation. So it's cool because there's some neat little Ohio connections. They keep going to Swenson's, which is this little drive-through that's, I think, originally from Ohio, and it's heavy in the Akron area. I think it came from Akron. And so, yeah, I love to see the Swenson loves. I mean, Swenson has some great burgers and milkshakes. That's the biggest fat guy comment I can make about it, is like, yeah, basketball, who cares? Let's talk more about milkshakes and hamburgers. So, I mean, if you're interested in LeBron James and you're interested in the detail of how high school basketball works as you're courting, no pun intended, for the NBA. But I mean, for somebody like me, it just, a lot was lost. I mean, it's an interesting look at James' early touches with fame, but the film suffers from an overlong running time, which is about 2 hours, and a focus on minutia. So unfortunately, I'm going to have to say, for me and my taste, this movie kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Platonic. Rose Byrne and Seth Rogen star as platonic friends who reunite in their 40s, causing disruption into their lives.
Your friendship with Will is not built for this phase of life.
Oh, geez. This is how a woman experiences a midlife crisis.
You're like a couple of teenage girls. Your whole thing is so weird and destructive.
Can you believe she said we were destructive?
No! We're exactly the opposite.
We are constructive.
We're constructive.
I don't like feeling like the second most important man in your life.
Doritos are.
It's embarrassing being a mess in front of you. And Will's a much bigger mess than I am.
This dropped last week on Apple TV Plus. And Apple TV Plus tends to put three episodes out in the first part of a season, and then they'll do one episode each week. So they're eking out each episode. I watched three episodes of this. I don't want to watch any more because I have a feeling I'm going to go into a rage if I keep watching it. It started out, like the first episode, I'm like, yeah, it's kind of fine. It's okay. It wasn't my cup of tea. It's directed and run by Nicholas Stoller, who did the Neighbors movies, which, again, you had Seth Rogen and Rose Byrne, and they had chemistry in that, so they're putting them in a TV show together. But I feel about this series very much how I feel about the movie Funny People, which is that Judd Apatow movie from like 15 years ago with Adam Sandler. When I first saw that in the movie theater, I thought, it was okay. It was fine. Okay, you know, decent movie. And then I saw it once on Blu-ray when it came out, and I liked it less. And then I for some reason, I think I watched it a third time. Maybe I was having to do an article about it. I forget why. But then I hated it. And I'm like, I'm not going to watch it anymore because it'll become the worst movie ever. And it wore on me. And I feel the same way about Platonic. The original concept and the idea, I'm like, okay, this is fine. But by the time I got to the third episode, I'm like, I hate these characters. And you can have unappealing, imperfect, problematic, flawed characters, but you have to like them. Like a great example is in the series, It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia. They're horrible people. They are dysfunctional, problematic, unlikable people, but they're hilarious. This show, I just don't like the characters. And I realized I zeroed in on it. I think it's Rose Byrne. I felt that way about the show Physical, which is also on Apple TV Plus. And I don't know about her personally. I've never met Rose Byrne. She's probably perfectly lovely. There's something about the characters she plays when they get too real. I just don't like it. Maybe it's because she's colossally attractive, and so you're sort of predisposed to like somebody if they're attractive. And then I'm like, every time I see, like when I watch Physical and then when I watch this, I'm like, no, she's a unpleasant person. The character is an unpleasant person. I do not like her. I mean, she's whiny and complainy, but everyone has to be like, oh, but you're beautiful. I'm like, do we really have to go out of our way to remind Rose Byrne how attractive she is? Do we really need to? She's won the lottery of life. She's a gorgeous woman. Do we need to keep pointing that out? And going back to Funny People, that's the way I feel about Leslie Mann. I get it. Judd Apatow in that situation is like, I'm this schlub with this attractive wife. But we don't have to keep pointing that out. I find that shallow and I find that unappealing. And so no matter how attractive you are, if you are a unappealing, caustic character, I don't like you. And that's my problem with this movie. I mean, I know there are people who just adore Rose Byrne. And she just rubs me the wrong way. And every minute she spends on screen, I like the character even less. So ultimately, insufferable characters make the stab at comedy difficult to enjoy or even watch. I'm going to say that Platonic totally sucks.
It sucks.
Coming up next on Fat Guys at the Movies, I'm going to be talking about Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse and the Boogeyman. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the movie reviews and talk about Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse. Gwen Stacy and Miles Morales team up across dimensions to attempt to fix the multiverse.
My name is Miles Morales. I'm Brooklyn's one and only Spider-Man. And things are going great.
Miles! Want to get out of here?
Oh! Gwen? So wait a minute. There's an elite crew with all the best spider people in it?
Who's the new guy?
This is unbelievable.
What's a guy got to do to join this spider team?
You can never be part of this.
You have a choice between saving one person and saving every world.
I really enjoyed the original Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, which came out in 2018. I thought the animation was innovative and different and cool, and I thought it really opened it up for multiverse ideas. 5 years later, we've got another Spider-Man multiverse movie. And not only do we have these Into the Spider-Verse, but we also had Spider-Man No Way Home. Going back to 2018, the multiverse was new. Now, for somebody like me, I've been reading multiverse stories and comic books, and I've been watching multiverse stuff on movies and television for decades. I mean, it's going all the way back to Star Trek. So this is nothing new, but I think people have kind of been caught up to speed on what the multiverse is. And right now, the multiverse is, maybe it's just getting a little old. I mean, after Spider-Man No Way Home and Everything Everywhere All at Once and Loki and even Quantumania and, of course, Doctor Strange and the Multiverse of Madness, are we overmining the concept of the multiverse? Because now it's just very, very trendy and cool and everybody can do it. But I mean, you drop this pre-2018, nobody would have understood it because the mainstream audience didn't get that. To me, you got to do more than just present the multiverse. And I thought the original Into the Spider-Verse was very innovative with that and different and cool. This movie, it's more of just like a background presence. And I mean, while they have some neat multiverse bits to it, you can't sell a movie on that anymore. I mean, I really wanted to love this movie because I loved the first one, but I didn't love it. I liked it, but there are some problems to it. The first thing is it's too long. And I've said this about a lot of movies, but this thing's 2 hours and 20 minutes. There's no reason for that. I mean, it really is. There is no reason for that in this movie. I don't think there's enough story. I think they pad it. There's a lot of dialogue, but the dialogue's repetitive. The scenes are repetitive. They drag at times. There's also this real heavy heroes are born out of trauma message to this. And that's common in comic book type stuff. I mean, whether you're the last son of Krypton whose entire planet has been destroyed, or you're Batman whose parents were killed in front of you when you're a child, or whether you're Spider-Man and the original Peter Parker Spider-Man, Uncle Ben dying and that kicking off your journey. I get that. That's very common, especially with the Marvel stuff, the Stan Lee stuff. You know, trauma and angst is very heavy in Marvel superheroes. But this one lays it on a bit thick because that's kind of a theme of the movie. Because Gwen Stacy, as Spider-Gwen, she's born of trauma. And Miles Morales is born of trauma. And Peter Parker is born of trauma. And they just keep, they hammer it away. And then you add to it the fact that it's kind of telling it from a teen point of view. You've got the teen angst angle, which just it gets a bit much. And the animation, as cool as the animation is, and it's innovative and it uses all these different styles and it's layered, and at times it's, I mean, visually almost too much. They just throw more at you. And at a certain time, I just felt like the movie, I'm like, dude, back off a little bit. Not everything needs to be flashy and putting people into epileptic fits or anything like that. So I like the style and I like the innovative punchiness of the animation, you know, 2 hours of that is a lot. It reminds me of watching some anime where anime just keeps going and going and going, and the action sequences, they're overblown. And then on top of it, you've got this storyline that's a little bit heavy and isn't as diverse as it really should be for... They just keep showing up with new spider characters. And at a certain point, you're just like, okay, do we need to have a long blown explanation for each one of them? There's some great stuff in this movie. There really is. But there's also stuff that gets in its own way. The first movie was just leaner and better told. And this one, it gets a little punching at times. I mean, it's not nearly as fresh and efficient as its predecessor, with an overlong running time and frenetic animation. It's still fun and innovative with the feel that it spawned from the love of the comics. I mean, this really feels like they're drawing from the comics rather than an egotistical director kind of going off on his or her own. So there's some great stuff in here. It's just not as good as it could be. So I'm going to have to say that the Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse, I'm going to give it a kind of rocks, but I'm a bit disappointed.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about The Boogeyman. A grieving family is haunted by an entity that attacks loved ones under the cover of darkness.
It's been around forever. Hidden. In the dark. It's like all those spooky monsters you think are hiding under your bed.
What is this? It's the thing that comes for your kids when you're not paying attention.
You believe me? Don't you?
I'm a huge Stephen King fan. I discovered Stephen King when I was in middle school, which is probably too young to be reading his books. And it's been a long time since I've read Night Shift. But I want to go back and read the original Boogeyman story just to compare. I mean, he wrote this thing, I think it showed up in Cavalier magazine in the 70s. It was one of his earlier stories. And I was curious to see this movie. I was kind of excited. And the biggest problem with this film is it's one of those trendy, underlit movies. I talked about this with The Pope's Exorcist. I literally couldn't tell what was going on in the film. There's scenes where, like, you have a jump scare, and I'm like, I don't know what you were supposed to be afraid of, because I just saw a shadow. And maybe it was because the theater I saw it in, which was poorly projected, which is unfortunately a problem now. There's a lot of theaters out there that have bad projection. It makes it even harder to watch. This movie is murky. It's dark. I'm not saying dark in terms of subject matter. I mean, from a luminosity standpoint, it's dark. And a little bit of darkness makes for a good horror movie. A lot of darkness just is boring because you can't see anything going on. And I mean, they lean into it. I mean, this whole story is this father, played by Chris Messina, and he's a psychologist, and his wife has been killed in a car accident, and so he's trying to get over it, and he's got two daughters. He's got a teenage daughter and a younger daughter, and they're grieving. And like the teenage daughter, it's just every single cliche about the surly girl going to school, and then you got the other girl at school who's kind of a jerk, you know, the B word. And I mean, there's nothing unique about it. And I get it. It's an old story from what, 40, 50 years ago, but at least do a due diligence and try and put together a unique character. This is just a cookie cutter character. And the little girl's the same way, but I couldn't see anything that was going on in this movie. And sure, it might have been the projection of the theater, but also there's like a scene where she walks into a room and turns on a light switch, and like this like 7-watt light bulb in the corner goes on, and I'm like, really? Buy a freaking lamp, people. And the whole place is just murky and dark, and I couldn't see anything that was going on. And then it plays so heavily into the horror is trauma and trauma is horror, and that's what we're going to base on. Look, Smile, I thought, did a really interesting job with it last year. Smile was a much better movie cohesively attaching horror and trauma. This feels very derivative and uninspired, but it all goes back to the lighting, which is impossible to see. I mean, underlit and murky sludge makes this derivative trauma as terror film a bore. I'm going to have to say that the Boogeyman sucks.
It sucks.
Coming up next on Fat Guys at the Movies, I'm going to be talking about the Ted Lasso finale and the Home Cinema Roundup featuring 65. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's finish up the reviews, and I want to talk about Ted Lasso. I know I technically reviewed the season when it debuted a couple weeks ago, but it wrapped up finally, and I thought that it was worth talking about because everybody's talking about it this week. This award-winning series takes a final bow as AFC Richmond faces its rival in the championship.
That is the Ted Lasso I want coaching my team this season. The one who's willing to fight. Understood?
Yes, ma'am. You watch. From now on, I'll be floating like a butterfly and stinging like a bee. Except I won't die immediately after using my stinger. I plan to float and sting for the entirety of the whole season.
I love you guys so very much.
On three. One, two, three.
I love you guys so very much! Richard!
Great
catch them!
Oh! Roy Kent just said, great job!
Now, I love Ted Lasso from Kickoff. Before it even came out, I watched it for review several years ago in the first season, and I just fell in love with it. I fell in love with it so hard that I made my family watch it. And my whole family just loved it. And we loved the first season. And then the second season, I thought they did a great job making the second season more serious and tackling some greater issues and tackling the stigma of mental health and getting therapy and getting help. It did a great thing in normalizing mental health. And then they had this third season, and you know, everybody in the internet loves to tear things down. And there's been this discourse going on with Ted Lasso all season where people are going, oh, it's not the same, it's not as good. And there's just as many people complaining about the finale. But I got to say, I loved the finale. I love the way this show ended. I mean, is it realistic? No. I hate this concept of, well, we're going to end a series, so we need to kill somebody. I wasn't a huge fan of the show ER. But one of the things I loved about the ending of ER is that final episode, life just went on. They pull back from the ER, and it's like people are still working at the ER. You don't have to murder all your characters. You know, that's what you always tell. Well, who's going to die at the end? Well, nobody has to die. And I love the fact that Ted Lasso, as a series, they're like, we're not going to fall for that. Is it realistic that everybody's happy and everybody gets an uplifting send-off? Maybe not. But who cares? Do we have to have everyone die at the end of the... No, that's unrealistic too. Ted Lasso is fantastic comfort food. And this final episode, it wraps up Ted's story. Is the show over? Well, I think Ted Lasso, as the name of the show, is over. Because Ted went through his arc and he's going on to something different. He's, you know, and okay, then I'm going to engage a little bit in spoilers, but he goes back to America. And if you actually look at this season, Ted took a real backseat to the stories. This season was about all these other characters. And part of that's because Ted had his moment of discovery and his moment of truth in season two. And that's okay. And he sort of carried it on through this. And he was still a character and he still had presence. But there are all these other characters that had interesting stories too. And that's what they were exploring in season three. I believe the story is going to continue. I think they are going to do spinoffs. And you can do spinoffs because you don't need Ted in order to continue the Richmond story. And the reason I think that works is because it's a bad message to say, in order to keep this uplifting, positive attitude, we need this character in there. Well, then it's not the people making that change for themselves. The whole purpose of Ted Lasso, they literally spell it out in the final episode, the Diamond Dog scene where Roy is sort of opening up to the guys. They explain it. They say, look, you don't change who you are, but you strive to be better. And are you better if you have to have somebody constantly looking over you? No, you're not. You have to let Ted go at a certain point. And you have to let him go back to America, and you can still continue the positive attitude he had. And that's what I think happened. Now, are there silly things in it? Sure. And if you want to hate, you can hate. The goodbye, so long, farewell, a Wiedersehen, goodnight. That whole sequence, is it goofy and silly? Yes. Is it unrealistic that a football club in Britain would do that? Yeah, it's unrealistic. But that's part of the fun of the show. It's ridiculous, but it's very charming. And I thought Ted Lasso went out with a bang. Absolutely loved it. Show still rocks. Third season still rocks. Totally stuck the landing.
It rocks.
Excellent!
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. The spotlight this week is on 65, which stars Adam Driver. It's a sci-fi adventure. After encountering an asteroid field, a transport vessel crash lands on Earth in prehistoric times.
Charter 373. This is Commander Mills. My ship was hit by an undocumented asteroid, transporting 35 passengers on a long-range exploratory mission. Send help. We've crash landed on an uncharted celestial body. I've located one survivor.
A child.
There's something alien out there.
I found this fascinating because when the trailer for this dropped, people kind of were, hey, this looks really good. I'm excited to see it. And then the movie came out and it kind of came and went and completely flopped. And I'm like, well, that was uninspiring. And I kind of wanted to see it. So, of course, it came out on 4K Blu-ray. And it looks good on the 4K. Any sort of science fiction thing with technology, you can make that look really good in 4K. And I will say this. We are at the point that even a run-of-the-mill sci-fi movie, I mean, this thing's not a $250 million blockbuster. But it looks great. I will say the effects do not break down, even on 4K, 5 feet from the screen. So it looks good. And I will say, you know, unlike something like The Boogeyman, this thing's pretty well lit for what it needs to do. It's the color palette's a little bland. It's very dark and gray and silver, but it's not so dark you can't see it. And that's a good thing. The movie itself is a pretty simple story. The strength of the movie is it's not long. It's like 90 minutes. And if this movie were 2.5 hours, it would be insufferable. But it's 90 minutes because the whole thing is it's this transport that crash lands on this uncharted world and turns out it's Earth and it's in prehistoric times. So there's dinosaurs and stuff that they have to deal with, but they don't know anything about the planet. And everyone else is dead except for this one young girl. And Adam Driver has to get her to safety and get on an escape pod, because when the ship crashed, another part of it went somewhere else and they have to brave the wilderness. So it's ultimately a survival piece. But the one thing that's weird about it is sort of the catch to the movie. Whenever you have a movie, the catch, you have to say, what's this about? And you're like, and the movie's called 65. And if you know anything at all about dinosaurs 65 million years ago, was the end of the reign of dinosaurs. So it's pretty clear it's on Earth. And you're like, is it time travel or is it another planet? Well, the whole thing is that it's another world where humanoid beings have evolved. But they sort of hold that back from the first act, and then you realize, oh, it's just they crash landed on Earth. There's no time travel involved. But when your premise is your catch, it sometimes makes it feel a little anticlimactic to watch the movie. But I mean, overall, I thought it was fine. I mean, it falls into these tropes. And of course, like the girl that he's the only survivor, he's transporting her to the other part of the ship. He's trying to keep her alive, but she can't speak English or whatever the language is. And so there's a language barrier. So it plays around with stuff we've seen before. And it's written by the people who did A Quiet Place. Not John Krasinski, but the writers of it. So it does play around with something very similar. Whereas like in The Quiet Place, it was him with a daughter who was deaf. And in this one, it's a guy who can't communicate effectively. It's not a terrible movie. It's not great. But I think the thing that saves it is the short running time. I mean, it's 90 minutes. You're in and you're out. And it's something that I would have seen back in the day when I would go to these 24-hour science fiction movie marathons. And it would be one of these premieres that nobody really had seen in the mainstream, but it would have made an interesting thing to watch at like 1 a.m. Now, the Blu-ray comes with some special features. It's got some deleted and extended scenes and some behind-the-scenes stuff about making the prehistoric planet and the concepts and the development. So there are some decent special features as well. Nothing huge, but worth checking out. I think if you miss this one in theaters, it's worth seeing. It doesn't take too long, and it's kind of a pleasant surprise. I mean, it's a passable sci-fi survival adventure, which pushes a thin premise to a mercifully short ending. I'm going to say it kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for this week. I need to go. When I come back next week, I'm going to be talking about Transformers: Rise of the Beasts. And until then, have a fat time at the movies or at home.